Paper 11, section 8, which is old single column, page 125. We're just, you'll see what we kind of just pick up where we left off last time. Maybe one just thing to remind you of that. Definitely the theme gets picked up again. Recall how they brought up the whole issue of the levels in the Master Universe, providing effectively anti-gravity influence on the system. You know, it's a means of preventing massive condensations, gravitational condensations of building up, just because you have everything sheared like that into levels. And so you'll see they're going to bring up a few other things along that line here. So we'll pick through those things. I'll try to help you appreciate exactly what they're bringing up there.
8. Paradise gravity. The inescapable pull of gravity effectively grips all the worlds of all the universes of all space. Gravity is the all-powerful grasp of the physical presence of paradise. Gravity is the omnipotent strand on which are strung the gleaming stars, blazing suns, and whirling spheres, which constitute the universal physical adornment of the eternal God, who is all things, fills all things, and in whom all things consist.
Okay, now, can you answer the question? You read that paragraph. I mean, if you ask yourself, why is that paragraph in there? And notice the flavor of that paragraph. I mean, that didn't sound like a physics text. Okay? Okay, we're just about to read about material gravity. So what do? They started off with a paragraph to appeal to your sensitivity to spiritual gravity, to draw you in. Yeah, they know who's reading this, you know, especially in the early stages of the Revelation. They know. It's likely to be people that have only a limited interest, at least initially, in things non-spiritual, and so they do this a lot in the Revelation. They'll use spiritual gravity like this as a technique to draw you in, to get your attention. I mean, it mentions the Trinity teacher sons even do that, you know, in their teaching, to use spiritual gravity to help draw the students into a state of interest about what's there. It's like, well, that was really intriguing. I want to keep going, you know, and, you know, it's immediately going to shift gears, but they're hoping that was enough of a compelling fact to hook you in, and get you to take up the more difficult challenge of opening that other eye and really creating a relationship with individuality details so that you can combine it with what you felt spiritually, you know, with that poetic construct that they just gave you there. Okay, so that's... just that fact that that it's not a coincidence that it's spiritual gravity being used to draw you in to think about material gravity. All right.
The center and focal point of absolute material gravity is the Isle of Paradise, complemented by the dark gravity bodies encircling Havona and equilibrated by the upper and nether space reservoirs. All known emanations of Nether Paradise invariably and unerringly respond to the central gravity pull operating upon the endless circuits of the elliptical space levels of the Master Universe. Every known form of cosmic reality has the bend of the ages, the trend of the circle, the swing of the great ellipse.
Okay, now, let me get you back in the space we were talking about last time. By and large, we're still in a mode where we're talking about the influence of paradise, the, you know, the physical gravity influence of paradise in the macroscopic picture, in the big picture. We're not thinking about particle physics. We're not, you know, by and large, we're not thinking about the little details. We're thinking about the big picture. Okay, and the Isle of Paradise, in and of itself, just, you know, just as a singular fact that could manifest an influence on, you know, space and time as we experience it, you know, it's absolutely transcendent of any relationship to, you know, scale in the space in which we are. I mean, it doesn't know about big, small, or, you know, it's absolutely transcendent of scale, you know, and geometry and everything, you know, angles and everything. So, it, you know, in terms of just what it does by itself in the big picture, the main thing that you can think of that it's doing by itself is the whole big picture has a center of symmetry. You know, this whole giant, whether you think about it in the Maltese cross analogy or the hourglass analogy or whatever, you know, that Master Universe is definitely a vast symmetric structure with a central point to it. The fact that there's a central point in that geometry, even though the Isle isn't literally in space at that point, see, it's because of that absolute centering influence of the Isle on the whole. Okay. But the details of the structure are just that. They're details. They are qualified. There's levels with different widths, and there flows in different directions, and you know, it's denser in the plane than above. All these relative facts. See, that's not an absolute expression. There's relativity there. It's the difference between, you know, this direction and this direction, etc. Okay. The only way that can be imposed upon the big picture is through what they just mentioned there. Okay, the center and focal point of absolute material gravity is the Isle of Paradise, okay, comma, complemented by the dark gravity bodies encircling Havona. The dark gravity bodies are an extension of the Isle, but in a downstepped fashion. They're a downstepped extension of the Isle. The influence of the Isle is imposed, you know, most of the stuff that you see imposed is not imposed directly, but it's imposed through the dark gravity bodies. The dark gravity bodies are not wholly absolute like the Isle. So they can impose a relativity, a qualified nature to the picture. They can make the structure have the elliptical shape. They can make levels and alternate flows and all these details, you know, different up from, you know, than relative to the plane. All that is a manifestation of the influence of the Isle coming through those dark gravity bodies. Okay, they're elliptical. Therefore, you know, their circuits are elliptical. And therefore, everything else can be elliptical, etc. Okay, so that's just, you know, keep that in mind always. That when you're, you know, a lot of times when they use the expression, say, circular gravity when they're talking about paradise gravity, you know, they're thinking in that big macroscopic sense. And And just remember, I mean, it only does that because it's gone through the dark gravity bodies. And then that one other thing in this regard is, this should remind you, the picture of the aisle is really the picture looking from where we are back through the dark gravity bodies to the source, so that when they describe a certain geometric shape and whatnot for the aisle, I mean, that's not what it is as an absolute fact. I mean, you can basically think of that's the interface between the absolute and the sub-absolute projected into the finite. That interface could be described as an elliptical pancake, you know, with these dimensions and stuff. I mean, they're giving you a projection. You know, the actual nature of separation and stuff on the aisle is just completely transcendent of anything that you can depict in any sort of a simple geometry like they describe. Okay, that's not a literal depiction of the aisle. It's in the same way that the picture of Havona is the projection of the higher dimensionality, you know, and by and large an absonite dimensionality of Havona projected into the finite. It looks like that. You know, you have to begin to transcend your current relationship with space and time in order to get into Havona. It's a transcendent domain. Okay. So what, you know, that's sort of that first level of projection of what it really is into a finite picture. And you just, the closer you get to the center of everything, the farther things are being projected down, the more distortion there is. You know, so they're painting a picture that gives you some measure of the truth, you know, the philosophical nature of it, but don't think, you know, simplistically about it. You know, it's not, you know, just literally like they're saying. It's not that simple. It's much more grand than that, grand in ways that we can't comprehend, so they can't even begin to describe it to us. You know, the geometric beauty and symmetry of what it really is. Okay, we're seeing, they're depicting a shadow. Yeah.
What's said in the second paragraph and on has to do with physical reality, but remember that higher reality. Remember absolute stability, the infinite upholder, divine consistency. Mm-hmm. Those things are what make all that cohesive.
Yeah, and certainly when you're speaking like they were, you know, where they're saying, you know, things like the adornment of the eternal God, you know, speaking, you know, basically of the universal Father, behind the aisle and its influence, immediately behind the aisle and the influence and its influence, nothing intervening, is the non-personal expression of the first source and center, the universal controller. You know, to see the influence of the aisle is to see that non-personal expression of the first source and center of all, not just beings, but things and beings. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, definitely a point well taken. Okay, so, you know, again, you know, I mean, they mentioned the reservoir space, the upper and lower reservoirs, and that is just kind of always just there, you know, as a curiosity kind of in the background. You never can really think too literally about exactly what it's doing and how or anything, but, you know it somehow is part of the equilibration of the whole thing, like they say there. But the dark gravity bodies, I mean, that's something that you don't want to just gloss over that. That's extremely important. If you start forgetting about those and imagining that the aisle is directly making the levels and all that stuff, that's illogical. You know, that's lowering the aisle to a sub-absolute fact, and you don't want to do that. The aisle is absolute. You know, you want to come to terms with that absoluteness. You don't want to degrade the nature of the aisle any more than you want to degrade the nature of the universal Father, you know, and turn him into some simplistic anthropomorphism. Okay, they need to be absolute. You know, and in the case of the first source and center, even more, you know, even beyond the absolute. But, yeah, you're going all the way to the infinite upholder. Okay, so there we are. We're thinking about the kind of the big picture stuff again.
Space is non-responsive to gravity, but it acts as an equilibrant on gravity. Without the space cushion, explosive action would jerk surrounding space bodies. Pervaded space also exerts an anti-gravity influence upon physical or linear gravity. Space can actually neutralize such gravity action, even though it cannot delay it. Absolute gravity is paradise gravity. Local or linear gravity pertains to the electrical stage of energy or matter. It operates within the central, super, and outer universes wherever suitable materialization has taken place.
There's a whole bunch of things. Let's slow that paragraph down a little bit. Why don't we pull the statement about the pervaded space out first and just get that dealt with, and then we'll deal with the bigger issues in there. So that comment about pervaded space also exerts an anti-gravity influence upon physical or linear gravity. Space can actually neutralize such gravity action, even though it cannot delay it. Okay. That sentence should remind you a bit of what I was, you know, pointing you back to in the previous section when they were talking about the quote-unquote anti-gravity influence of the levels and the fact that they're going in opposite directions so that you separate things that might be wanting to pool together. Okay, here the key is to bring in in a sense something that's much more important when you go to start to understand the microscopic issues, you know, the particle physics issues. Remember when we were reading about Nether Paradise and we were kind of thinking about those basic things they were telling us, and we said, well, just for the sake of kind of an initial picture of things, trying to understand the things initially, kind of just think of the force charge of space, now that which is pervading space, as being kind of like a fluid that's going to flow. You know, so we were kind of thinking of it in ether-like terms, sort of. You know, the old ether from 100 years ago or more. Okay, this is reminding you that that's not literally the case. It isn't a static thing. Everything is a motion. Okay, the primordial force, you know, that fills space, that pervades space, that is a charge of space, is actually a motion, an outward motion, innately what it is, and it's not outward in the sense of vectorially flying radially outward, say from the center or something like that. It's just outward. Okay? Gravity, we all have experience with gravity, and we know the basic thing about gravity. You know, if you have a bunch of things under the influence of gravity, they all want to go inward towards each other. You know, it's an inward directed phenomenon, not an outward-directed phenomenon. So you can see there's obviously an anti thing in play here, opposites, okay? A simple thing to think about is just, you know, when you look at a light bulb, you know, you think about the photons that are being generated there and going out and illuminating the room, okay? So you got a bunch of things there, photons, they're particles, things. You watch what those things do. Do they do the gravity-like thing and go inward and collect together into a ball? No, they just go flying in every direction outward. Okay? So that's an example, see, of a phenomenon that is doing the anti of what gravity does. It's going outward. They don't, you know, those photons are showing you what kind of emotion the force charge has, because they're just like marker dots. They don't have independent motion of their own. They're just, they're little points in the force charge in a sense that you can see. Think about them simplistically like that. Imagine they're like little marker dots so that you can make the invisible visible and kind of see what it's doing. And so you put all these little marker dots on it and then watch what happens. And all the marker dots go phew in every direction. They just go flying outward in every direction. You know, they don't go all streaming in one, you know, it's not a vectorial motion or anything, you know. It's just, you know, it's just this outward thing. See, that's that foundation of the whole physical system, the force, charge of space, is an outward phenomenon. It has an anti-gravity nature to it. Okay. And so if, you know, that is always in the background, if the inward phenomenon, you know, is minimalized enough, you know, it fades into an outward phenomenon. You know, the photons don't have mass, and so you've really minimalized the simple linear gravity thing. All you see is the outward part. You know, if I magically gave them all mass, you know, I wouldn't see the outward. I'd just see this inward thing. Okay.
What do scientists think when they see this phenomenon?
Well, you know, see, the, you know, it's a bit shaky. You know, I mean, when they gave up the notion of a plenum, you know, that something that would that pervades everything, you know, and decided that it wasn't illogical to assume that there's a nothing. You know, and it's not as problematic philosophically if you get rid of a creator, because if you have a creator, I mean, a creator creates a something. So it's really illogical to think, well, I think he created a nothing. Well, no, that doesn't make sense. He has to create a something. There can't be a nothing. Everything has to be a something. If you get rid of a creator, well, then, you know, all you're left with is, well, you know, it's all magical. So, you know, why couldn't there just be a nothing? You know, and so then everything, you know, the foundation of all of physics, this magical, you know, it ends up can't be anything else but magical physics, is all resting on, seated on, you know, the foundation of everything is nothing. You know, the vacuum, you know, quote unquote. You know, and, you know, you, that would be really problematic, you know, if, so you have to kind of dream up schemes to get around that, you know, so you make space-time a substance to try to make, you know, all kinds of things that they've done to try to make up for the fact that you know, they have a fundamentally illogical picture, okay, that they're trying to rationalize everything with. Okay, so, you know, everything is, you know, on a bit, you know, you have to try to just somehow, you know, think that you can have photons, you know, or waves or whatever, you know, just in nothing. You know, and, you know, if you make it mathematical and abstract enough, it's not a problem. But it doesn't leave you much with, in terms of a literal objective picture, to try to really understand.
It's certainly not an
illusion. You know, okay, so, you know, they're electromagnetic waves, but every wave I know is in a medium. But these aren't. These are waves in nothing. You know, and it's like, well, the equations work. I mean, so, yes, yeah, I mean, it's mathematically rational, but it's not very satisfying philosophically.
See, the way they're thinking needs to be reoriented to the waves are the medium. Right?
Well, the force charge is the medium.
Yeah, right.
You know, and the medium is in motion.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and yeah, you know, if you make a kink in the medium, it'll look like a wave going by.
Okay.
These sorts of things.
So it's a kink.
All right.
So does the force charge, is that the speed of light?
Right, yeah, that has a uniform outward motion of, you know, unity. You can just call it unity, but, you know, if you express it in meters and seconds, you get, you know, the speed of light of 299. But, you know, it's, you know, the fact that it's, let me just say one more thing about that, and then we'll get back to the macroscopic physics. But, you know, that fact that what they've found out about the speed of light, that it's not a relative phenomenon. You see, right, that's just telling you right there that you have a fundamentally, you know, over-circumscribed picture. I mean, if you assume everything is finite, then everything has to be relative. But it's easy to demonstrate that the speed of light, whatever the heck it is not relative. Therefore, it's not finite. Therefore, your initial assumption is false. There has to be something. At least one thing is obviously transfinite. And not to mention every other thing that is not relative. That's not a function of space or time. Everything is just screaming logically that there has to be a transfinite aspect of physical reality. Or everything would be relative. Okay, so that's that. That's the quote-unquote anti-gravity thing there, that outward motion that fundamentally is the force charge, this pervading space. Now, the rest of it, okay, is a little more straightforward. Yeah, we can, that first part, space is non-responsive to gravity. Okay, what's that speaking to in terms of 20th century physics? What's the theory of gravity that was dreamt up in the 20th century by a guy named Einstein? No, that's not gravity. Curved space-time, general relativity. Right. The whole notion that that space is responsive to gravity, that space is affected, by a mass and vice versa. This is a coupled system, right? This is okay. No, okay. Right. I mean, it's a rationalization scheme that can get you the answer to some questions, but it's not literal. I mean, space is not a substance that's curved in any way. It has nothing to do with gravity. It's non-responsive to gravity. Okay. In one, two, three, four, five words, we just got rid of general relativity. In thinking of general relativity as literal, as somehow depicting objective reality. No, it doesn't. Okay.
Well, is he going to be embarrassed?
Well, actually, he kind of knew there was something wrong. But
yeah, the rest of the sentence.
Okay, so now the rest of it. Okay. The rest of it, forget about general relativity. Newtonian gravity works just fine to think about what they're saying here. Okay, when Newton put forward his notion of gravity, that if you have two masses, he said that there's a force between these two masses, an inwardly directed force. Along the line connecting the two masses, it's a linear gravity, like they keep saying, okay? The line between the two masses. Okay? And this force is not in the kind of force that anyone was used to thinking of when Newton put that forward. It isn't the kind of force where literally my hand makes contact with the arm of the couch and pushes on it. There's no actual contact. These two objects, these two masses, are separated by a distance, and there's nothing in between them. So you have an action, like the action of me pushing on the couch, but it's action at a distance. It's not, it's not intimate. Okay. So, he described that force as action at a distance. Okay. That the earth just reaches out across the nothing and grabs a hold of the moon. Okay. And acts on it. Action at a distance. Okay. Yeah.
Magnets do that.
Right. That's the way we do all of our, charges and everything. We all think of this, they're all extrapolations of initially, and the initial way they're thought about is in this, just like Newtonian gravity, action at a distance, okay? But there's more to the theory of Newtonian gravity than just the force being proportional to the product of the two masses. This action at a distance, this pulling between these two masses, there's another part to the picture. the product of two masses divided by the square of the distance between them. Okay? So now, what if that square of the distance between them part of the equation wasn't there? What if it wasn't divided by, you know, r squared? Okay? What if this action of the distance was not diminished? What if, you know, two things were just coupled together by this action at a distance without any, you know, dilution of it, you know, by getting farther away? Well, if one of these objects went like this, the other object would be jerked with it, no matter how far away it was. Okay? You know, so, you know, if I imagine jerking the sun sideways, every star in the universe would jerk sideways. Okay? It'd be a pretty touchy universe. Okay? Okay? It's like no one move anything. Okay? Yeah, because every time you do, the whole, it shoves everything around in the whole universe. Okay? 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 Okay?
Well, wait, everything's already in motion.
But, you know, If this action at a distance diminishes as the distance gets greater, if it's far enough away, I can jerk this thing and this thing, you know, basically doesn't feel it at all. Okay? Okay. So this whole bit about, see, it acts as an equilibrant without the space cushion. See? The fact that action at a distance falls over is the square of the distance. Okay. You know, it's not even 1 over r, it's 1 over r squared. So it falls off pretty rapidly. So, you know, you don't have to get very far away and you're safe. You know, so it can do whatever it wants and you're not going to be jerked around by it. Okay? Okay? So, you know, that's what they're alluding to there. Well, more than alluding, that's what they're speaking to directly there. And then that whole bit of space can actually neutralize such gravity action, even though it cannot delay it. The pervaded stuff aside, like we read that, just the space. I mean, obviously, the gravity, you know, even in the simple Newtonian thing, this gravity is thought of as reaching all the way to infinity. It just, you know, but it's just its influence gets so tiny, you get very far away, it effectively neutralizes it. See, but it's not delaying it. It's not like it's eliminating it. You know, it's just the space is providing an effective shield from it, a buffer, a cushion.
Does the force charge of space get weaker as it goes out?
No, it's absolutely the same everywhere. You know, that's why it's not called an energy. That's why it's called a force. A force is a physical fact that doesn't have any difference between two points. Okay, an energy is literally something that has a differential. That's what makes it an energy, if it has a differential. You know, so you, no matter what kind of an electrode you think of building, no matter how magical your garage fabrication is, you know, of trying to make a perpetual motion machine, okay, there's no way to plug two electrodes into the force charge of space and have it power a light bulb or something, okay, because there's no differential. The force charge right here is exactly the same as it is right here. Okay. But if you modify that into an energy, okay, now you've got a differential. Now it can power something. Okay. So the force charge of space isn't some zero-point energy or something. It isn't some magical reservoir that if we just build the right gizmo, you know, we'll have free energy. Okay, it's not energy, it's force. It's pre-force. Or pre-energy, you know, it's force. Okay. Okay. Yes, yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, the motion is absent because it's, you know, transcendent like it is. It's not relative. All right. So they're just pointing out that contrast, and so we're going to talk about absolute gravity. You know, that's paradise gravity, and local or linear gravity, where you're actually getting to the electronic level. You start with an ultimaton. You build things up. You finally get a full system of 100 ultimatons. And you finally build up on that foundation. You know, that's the electronic level foundation, the collection of 100. You start building up on that. Finally, you get something that's big enough that has this property that we call mass. Okay, and then you're really, really in the domain of linear gravity. The domain of Newton's equation. Yeah. And the stuff that's electronic level but doesn't literally have mass, like a photon, to explain what you see it doing relative to gravity, like, you know, the whole bit of light rays being bent by the sun, that sort of stuff. Okay, you got to dream up some fancier scheme like Einstein did. You have to get up to the electronic level. You have to get up to the level of, you know, those minimal objects of photons, neutrinos, electrons, whatnot, and then everything above that, before you actually have this local or linear gravity going on. And this is a relative thing rather than an absolute thing, the absolute gravity of the aisle. And like I said, I mean, it's only literally an absolute gravity if you're just talking about the direct influence of the aisle on something. If the influence is going through the dark gravity bodies, okay, then it's not literally absolute anymore. You know, it's going to be sub-absolute. It's got some sort of relativity to it. You know, like it's doing this here and not there. You know, okay.
Parallel functionality to the kind of equilibrating that you need for Paradise gravity. I don't think Paradise gravity rolls off at the square.
Right. See, and again, I mean, you know, the aisle touches every point, you know, in the master universe equally. There's no 1/r². There's no spherical dilution. I mean, does everyone appreciate that? Why it's 1/r². You're taking a point influence, and you're spreading it out over a sphere. You know, with that point of influence at the center of the sphere. What's the area of a sphere? 4πr². Okay. You know, that surface area of that sphere is, you know, it has to be something. Product of two distances, if it's going to be an area, okay, it's r squared, 4πr². So, I mean, really, so you're dividing by the area. You're taking the product of the two masses in Newtonian gravity. You're taking the product of the two masses and dividing it by the area that you've spread the influence over. Okay.
Yep. Were you saying just a minute ago that gravity coming through and also force coming through the dark gravity bodies is altered?
The absolute gravity influence of the aisle goes through the part of it that goes through the dark gravity bodies, yes, is definitely modified. It's downstepped. It's not absolute anymore.
It's
sub-absolute.
So the gravity that operates in the grand universe isn't absolute.
Those part that goes through the dark gravity bodies, but there's some things that don't go through the dark, you know. The aisle also, you know, as the point of influence at the center of every ultimaton, that's an absolute fact. Okay? You know, and that's why an ultimaton is not some sort of an elliptical pancake object. It's a perfect sphere. See, there's no relativity. It's not going through the dark gravity bodies. It's manifesting directly, and the only way it can manifest is perfectly spherically.
I see. That's what gives everything a pancake. Like, look.
The dark gravity bodies do, yeah. That's what makes everything, yeah, have that structure. Because they're like that. They're in a plane.
But when matter is originating from the ultimatonic level and even from the force charge level, it has more spherical.
Yeah, right. I mean, it has this direct influence of the aisle, and then it's immediately put into this bigger macroscopic context where it's influenced by...
Yeah.
So it goes with the flow and stuff, but... You know, just
individual elements are all spherical.
Right. That's why. So you have to keep this separate. There's the macroscopic and the microscopic pictures are a little different.
So coming out from paradise through the dark gravity bodies exerts the sub-absolute influence, but coming up from the ultimatonic level,
and out of the force charge, you know,
is a spherical influence.
Right. Got that? Okay. Yep. So that's the key. That's one of the really kind of basic points that you want to sink in, so that, you know, in the rest of the book when they talk about this, you know, you're not blurring those two pictures together.
Do you know an ultimaton is spherical from just the book?
Yeah, because it says so. It says it has a radius. Okay.
I mean, nobody scientists can't see an ultimaton, right? They can't see one.
Yeah, it has a radius. I mean, they can't even see an electron, for Pete's sake, okay, you know, let alone an automaton. Okay.
They wouldn't use the term radius.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you know, you talk about semi-major axes or, you know, or whatever. Yeah, right, yeah, 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 yeah. Did you have something back here, too?
So what that downstepping, it goes through the gravity bus, it goes directly to linear gravity?
Well, no, there's two things. They mentioned that the dark gravity bodies impose both a linear gravity influence, you know, so they're of a very fancy mass of some sort, okay, but they're also this conduit phenomenon where they, you know, through them, you get something that's quasi-absolute, you know, it's, you know, like over the whole second outer space level, you know, there's this relative constancy of nature, you know, where the whole thing is going in this flow, for instance. It's not the whole master universe, so it's qualified to a degree, but it still has a very large scale where there's a uniformity, as if the influence of the eye was identical at every point. You know, so it seems like it's absolute until you get to the edge of the second outer space level and you go, oops, there's something changing here. Right, see, so I have a sub-absolute phenomenon. Okay. Right. So it's a, you know, it's a quasi, you know, absolute influence that it imposes and makes these big footprints. Okay. And then it also has a literal, you know, 1/r² like influence too. You know, and a massive one. Remember, they tell you that influence is, you know, that there's more of that kind of a linear gravity influence to the dark gravity bodies than all 7 super universes put together. You know, so it's a big linear gravity thing too. But yeah, but certainly it's not big enough to somehow, you know, being imposing some incredible linear gravity influence clear on the 4th outer space level. You know, that's mildly downstepped absolute influence that's creating the 4th outer space level, not a linear gravity influence. Okay. All right, let's see. Was there anything else there? Okay, yeah, so just, I mean, that last little bit. So the electronic level of matter, I mean, you know, that's the same. You've got that in the central, super, and outer universe. I mean, you have matter in the whole master universe picture. You know, so there's linear gravity going on everywhere.
The numerous forms of cosmic force, physical energy, universe power, and various materializations disclose 3 general, though not perfectly clear-cut, stages of response to paradise gravity. 1, pre-gravity stages, force. This is the first step in the individuation of space potency into the pre-energy forms of cosmic force. This state is analogous to the concept of the primordial force charge of space, sometimes called pure energy or segregata.
And you got a little kind of condensed version of paper 42, you know, here. They give you just a little overview here. To just remind you, you have this basic 3-step process. You know, you notice they're leaving out a bunch of the details up in paper 42. Because really what they want you to just appreciate at this point, paper 11, is the notion of potential, actual, real. 3 steps. So force, thinking of it as the potential for energy. You know, energy is then the actuality. And then if you purpose that energy into power, you know, it's a reality. So just that simple potentiality, actuality, reality picture that we use to understand so many things, our nature, you know, in all kinds of different ways, not just material, but mindful and spiritual. You have 3 reservoirs of potential, you know, that whole basic potentiality actually really, that's what they really want you to just make sure you appreciate, that the physical universe is that same 3-fold basic picture, okay? And so you have the force charge of space and the master force organizers, they can grab a hold of that stuff, even though we can't. They can grab a hold of it because they're transcendent. They have transcendent hands. They can grab a hold of it and do things with it. Mold it, you know, as it were, into energy. Make it so that it has a differential. Make it so that there's something here that's not here. Like, there's a whirl in the force charge here, but not there. See, that's a differential. You know, or there's an ultimate on here, but not there. That's a big differential. Here, over here first.
Chris, thanks. Yeah. So I'm starting to see some more words that aren't in my dictionary. It's a segregata that comes from
something. Well, yeah, okay. I mean, let me just, you know, mention that there's a lot of sort of direct and modified Latin happening here in coining words. I mean, you know, I don't know, it might, you know, it's hard to know if you should take the European tack on that and say segregata or if it should be segregata. Just think about the next one. The next one is very directly Latin. You have the three, the masculine, feminine, neuter. If you look at the italicized words, the end of the next one. You have ultimatus, ultimata, and ultimatum. You know, we use ultimatum, okay? okay. And, you know, we've seen that a lot of times, you know, like with motus, mota, motum. You know, they use the mota, that masculine, feminine, neuter. You know, so the fact that you call it ultimatum and not ultimatum. you know, makes you wonder. It's like, well, I should probably say ultimata then, if it's ultimatum. And so maybe it's segregata. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure how you decide on some of these things. But anyway, that's what they're getting at there in using those a suffixes like that is basically that it's what it is innately. Okay, it's innately ultimate. It hasn't been directed to that state. It's just made innately that way. It embodies that innately in its nature. Okay.
But why did they choose the prefix sacred?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, here, this is just what I'm pointing. I mean, you start with the space potency, and you have this first segregation, you know, differentiation from that. It doesn't produce something that has a spatial differential, so it's not energy in that spatial sense. Yeah, but remember, you can also use the word energy in a generalized sense, where both force, energy, and power are all called energy. Okay, see, and in that sense, you have something that's segregated from, you know, the absolute potential of the unqualified absolute. Okay, so
we got absoluta. Is that another?
Yeah, they don't bring that up here, but that's up in, you know, when you do paper 42, when they talk about space potency, they call it absoluta. So you have absolutus, absoluta, and absolutum. You see, they use absolutum for the aisle, you know, substance of the aisle. They use absoluta for space potency. You know, and absolutus, that's what we just use call in English the word absolute, the adjective absolute. Okay, let's do that one back here.
Is the ending masculine or feminine?
Feminine.
So does that relate to God the Mother?
No, not so much that way. And the masculine, feminine, neuter is, don't take it that high. It's directed, you know, and innate, and then an abstract thing, the UM. It's often two adjectives and a noun. It is, you know, direction-like and place-like, so it is male-female-like, see. You know, in that true sense of that differential, like the difference between the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit, okay, place and direction. So the revelators, you know, definitely play on that. And in many ways, they use that more definitively than the Latins did. They really kind of grab a hold of that. And, you know, like when they're using mota, you know, that's a great example. The Latins didn't use mota. They just used motas. You know, I mean, theoretically, you have all three words in Latin, but they didn't use the mota. They only used the motus, and that's motion in an overt sense. Like, you know, I throw a baseball. Okay, the motion of that ball across the room. So that's motus. Mota is not that overt, directed kind of motion. It you know, if you're going to use that word, it means something that's innately. In the sense of, like I always say, I mean, think about how we do this. I went to a symphony last night, and it moved me. Okay, you'll say that. Do you mean that it flung you across the room and slammed you against the wall of the concert hall? No. You don't mean motus. See? You actually mean mota. You mean it created this internal, innate motion feeling in you. Okay.
Doesn't that mean word? Mota?
M-O-T
means word in Latin.
No, it's it's literally motion. It's just three different words for motion. He was making the gerunds. So motus, mota, motum.
What's the word for word?
I don't remember. But I mean they also, you know, like, you know, versa. You have versus and versa and versum. You know, you have the basic notion of a rotation. It's like, well, there's two parts to a rotation. Do you mean the actual, you know, directed phenomenon? Or do you mean the hub? I mean, it's, you know, if you think of something rotated, there's two parts to that phenomenon. You know, there's the hub and then there's the circumference. Okay? Versus is the overt, you know,
circumference
phenomenon. Versa is the hub. You know, that's why they use U versa. It's the 21st hub. It's seven times three hub. You know, et cetera. See, they're using versa in that literal Latin sense of the hub, okay, of the rotation.
This force chart just goes through everything.
Right, it's permeating everything.
It's permeating everything. Yeah. We're too pixelized. You know what I mean by that? We're too pixelized. We're just these points, you know, here and there and here. Mm-hmm. We're just a bunch of points.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this smooth
right.
thing it's a, it's that has no points.
Right.
So the Paradise Force organizers have to be that same kind of thing. Otherwise, it would just go around them if they were pixelated.
Yeah. You know? Well, see, what it's like actually in the absinthe is another story. But because it's an absinthe fact, you know, what we experience in the finite is a continuum, a non-individuated fact. But what it actually is in an absinthe point of view, I don't know. It obviously has to have some kind of handles, or no one could grab it. Force, energy, power. Let's do the energy here.
2, gravity stages, energy. This modification of the force charge of space is produced by the action of the Paradise Force organizers. It signalizes the appearance of energy systems responsible to the pull of Paradise gravity. This emergent energy is originally neutral, but consequent upon further metamorphosis will exhibit the so-called negative and positive qualities. We designate these stages ultimata.
Okay, so see the positive, you know, positive and negative charges, that's an electronic level fact. Here we're talking about the sub-electronic domain, you know, the foundation of which is the ultimaton. Okay, it's not a particle like we know. All the particles we know are electronic level particles. They're they have a charge. You know, except for the few exceptions, like a neutrino or something. But, you know, you get that's the basic thing that we experience, is that whole positive and negative electrostatic fact about particles. The sub-electronic domain is prior to that. And so, you know, the ultimaton is just this little unit of motion. Okay, and you know, this whole bit about it, energy systems responsive to the pull of paradise gravity. In two ways. If I actually have an automaton, in the macroscopic sense, if I plop it in the middle of, say, the first outer space level, okay, it's going to go around in a clockwise flow. Okay, it feels that circular gravity, quote unquote, you know, that basically that absolute gravity, but it's downstep through the dark gravity bodies, of course. But that basic macroscopic thing, it feels that. It feels that paradise gravity, like they're saying there. But it also feels it in a microscopic sense. I mean, like, you know, the automaton feels the influence of the aisle directly. It's a physical phenomenon that manifests as a spherical fact. It's centered about the aisle. That, you know, whatever point it's at is a point of influence of the aisle. And so no matter how where it moves, it stays a sphere centered about that point, because the influence of the aisle is at every point. Okay, you know, if the if the influence of the aisle, you know, if the aisle didn't engage the master universe directly like that, so that it there's absolutely no break, you know, in its presence, as it were, you know, its centering influence is present at every point. If that wasn't true, you know, you'd have an automaton and all, you know, get over this region and then it'd just evaporate. You know, it would lose its centering and influence and disappear. Okay. See, so the aisle has, you know, this, that's why there's this direct absolute influence, so that there's everything is anchored in the absolute stability of the aisle. I mean, I can be absolutely certain that not a single automaton in my body, no matter what I do, is going to evaporate on me. Okay, I can even fuse. Okay, and I'll turn my whole body into a cloud of automatons, but there's the automatons are still there.
Yeah, they never go back.
Fusion doesn't, you know, override the aisle. Okay, fusion will override all of the atomic and molecular structure, everything, you know, and you know, even the collection of 100 automatons. It'll just turn me into a cloud of automatons, but. Yeah, but the automaton is still unmoved because the aisle is unmoved.
So the automaton feels all three forms of gravity. If this paradise gravity, the downstepped circular gravity, yeah. And if there's another automaton nearby.
No.
No?
No.
How do they get together then?
Yeah, that's that curious huddling proclivity. Not even the revelators really understand that phenomenon. Because, see, you know, this is way below the level. You know, you don't have mass until you're, you know, into the electronic level domain. We're at sub-electronic. There's no mass. There's no charge. There's no energy that we currently know about.
You know? No,
so there's no linear gravity between two automatons. Yeah. I mean, even if I have two collections of 100 automatons with nothing added to them, but just that electronic level base, there's no linear gravity. There's no mass. There's no charge. There's no mass. There's no nothing. Yeah. Before you have, yeah.
You were talking about below the electronic level.
Yeah. I mean,
there's some
kind of active.
There's certain levels.
The different waves.
There's like 10 or some levels below that.
Paper 40.
But yeah, I mean, you have that whole, that by the sub-electronic domain, I just mean everything that's below having something all the way up to a collection of 100. And all the way down to just one. That whole range of associativity of physical phenomena from singular automatons to collections of 100, that's the sub-electronic domain. Okay. And we know nothing about it in current physics.
100 automatons, but it doesn't respond to gravity.
Yeah, in the simple Newtonian sense, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Is the central aisle and the aisle of paradise, are we talking about two different things?
No.
So if the central aisle ends abruptly at the periphery, how is it everywhere?
Okay, again, remember, it's outside of space. Okay, so it's not anywhere in any, let's just take this room. Let's imagine the entire master universe is just contained in the walls of this room. This is the master universe. Okay, the Isle of Paradise is not in this room. Okay, the Isle of Paradise is outside of this room. But it's transcendent of the space of this room. So it's not like it's sort of sideways from us. It's not in the room next door or anything, you know, or above the roof or anything like that. Okay? It's beyond what you can experience by moving around this room. But it does engage this room. It's not just because it's not in the room doesn't mean that it doesn't engage the room. But if it's transcendent of what's going on in this room, you know, if it does engage this room, it's not like it's going to ooze in up in the corner up there and work its way across or anything. It has no relationship to left or right or up or down. It doesn't have any relationship to this rectangularness of this room. So if it engages this room, it engages every single point equally and simultaneously, but not from within, from without. It's omnipresent. It's not ubiquitous. Okay, so that's the difference. I mean, the presence of the Creative Mother Spirit, for instance, in Nebadon, she isn't omnipresent. She's ubiquitous. She's in this space, spread out, pervading the space. She's, you know, like the forest jars, you know, I mean, it's in and spread out through it. She's actually in here. But, you know, you take, say the infinite spirit. Okay, the infinite spirit is not in space, you know, like the creative mother spirit is. But the infinite spirit touches every point in space, has a presence at every point in space, but it's a transcendent presence. It touches every point from beyond that point, not from within the points. So it's omnipresent, not ubiquitous. Okay? The aisle is omnipresent. It's like, well, okay, so if the aisle is omnipresent, what kind of a presence does it have? Is it the same kind of presence as the infinite spirit or something like that? No. The kind of presence that it has, that it brings into this room, is that every point in this room has a centering influence. Every point in this room is special. Every point, if you create a material phenomenon in this room, it will want to center itself about the special point. That every point is special. Yeah.
As if it were the only one.
Every point is as if it's the only point in the universe.
Where's the abrupt end of it at the periphery?
Well, that is, they're talking about that, it's like, okay, so let's forget about space and everything, and let's just try to give you a simple analogy picture of the aisle that'll give you some sense of what you experience if you go there. Your experiences won't be like anything you've ever had. They won't be an experience like walking across a floor. But there'll be some analogous aspects to it. If you go there, you'll have an experience that's kind of like the experience you have when you walk across the ground. Okay? There's an underneath your feetness to the phenomenon. It's not like you're just floating in some, you know, ethereal place. There's solid and it's under your feet, and there's not solid and it's above your head. So that's analogous to things you've experienced. So they describe it that way. They say it also has an experience where if you start walking, it's not exactly the same everywhere. So we can't describe it as a sphere, because that would give you the sense that what you would experience, quote unquote, if you were walking around there, is that no matter where you were, it seemed like it was the same.
You could circumnavigate.
Right.
Yeah. It has an edge.
It has differentials to it.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Now, like they tell you, I mean, it's so vast that in terms of, you know, you still occupy a very small portion of its extent. So you're going along and, you know, you're walking, and the next thing you see this sign that says you are located at the center of the periphery, and you go, wait a minute, I didn't get to the edge. How could I be on the periphery? I mean, it's so huge that a right angle seems like a flat surface. Okay, it's that big. So you can walk around that, you know, if you hold it way back at a distance, it looks like a perfectly sharp right angle. But if you actually walk on the surface, it's so huge that the right angle seems like a plane. Okay? That's how big the aisle is. Okay? But, yeah, see, so, yeah, that's the point of that, is that like I said, they're trying to give you a sense of that there is differential to the aisle. There's places, when you're in that place, there's places where you experience spirit and there's places where you don't experience spirit. And those can be effectively analogized as an upper and a lower surface of a pancake picture. You know, again, the whole pancake picture is an analogy. It's just an analogy to give you a measure of the truth, but only to the limits that they can. I mean, keep it true, but highly limited.
It's really handy that you move by volition.
Yeah, and you right.
You'd take a long time to get anywhere.
Right. See, like even the thing about saying, imagine you're walking there. I mean, see, even that's pushing it because the separation and the sequence there is existential and not experiential. So it's just a very different place. Okay, but anyway. Okay, so we have a potentiality and an actuality. Meanwhile, back to force, energy, and power here. We have a potentiality and actuality, and we have a reality next.
3, post-gravity stages, universe power. In this stage, energy matter discloses response to the control of linear gravity. In the central universe, these physical systems are threefold organizations known as triada. They are the superpower mother systems of the creations of time and space. The physical systems of the super universes are mobilized by the universe power directors and their associates. These material organizations are dual in constitution and are known as gravita.
Which is it?
Well, you have gravitas. So you might think maybe it's gravitas. I'm not sure.
The dark gravity bodies encircling Havona are neither triada nor gravita, and their drawing power discloses both forms of physical gravity, linear and absolute.
Okay. Right. See, so there's that last little bit about the dark gravity bodies. They're the special exception. But, you know, see how they're pointing out. It's only now that once you get up to the electronic level and you have a collection of 100 automatons and stuff built upon that foundation, that linear gravity enters into the picture. You know, so an automaton, which is obviously must be automata or ultimata, see, is pre-linear gravity.
Well, I'm still confused by it. To
yeah, the curious huddling proclivity. I believe isn't that the exact that's words that they use? I think that's the words they use. Yeah, but you know, I mean, this is just what we know about the thing that's added. It's like, okay, I know about Newton's law of gravity and mass and all that sort of stuff. And okay, they're just telling me that Havona has kind of fancier stuff, but it's the same idea. But the big thing here, the big element of revelation, is what we're calling this. We're calling this power. And what is power?
Purposed energy.
Yeah, it's purposed energy. Okay? Think about the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. First principle of the Lucifer Manifesto is that there is no purpose in the universe. The universe is a purposeless fact.
Not real.
Okay? You know, it's the nihilistic principle. Okay? There is no purpose. It's like Lucifer. Okay, you're standing on a glob of matter, purposed energy. Okay, that's what it is. Okay. See, and that that's an extremely important thing. I mean, you know, neo-Darwinism is just like the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. These current modern notions that start with the assumption that there is no purpose. You know, and they may even go further. You know, they may say there's not only is there no purpose, there's no value, and there's no meaning. They may take it the next two notches too. But it all starts with there is no purpose. That's the fundamental assumption that so many so-called scientists are starting with. And I mean, this should appeal to your spiritual consciousness if you just let that sink in. Every element, every atom is a little nugget of purpose. It's not just an atom. It's been touched by that which can bestow purpose. Every atom has been touched by God and has given it purpose. Okay? And the reason that isn't just trivially obvious to us is because we haven't experienced a very mature material phenomenon. We've only experienced very immature material expressions. If you go to an architectural world, you experience a fully matured material expression where there's 100 elements, 100 material elements. Forget about the Mirage elements for the moment. Okay, there's 100 material elements. Every one of those is a nugget of purpose. 100 different, unique purposes. So you go to there and you start walking around, and you see 100 different elements all doing exactly what they were designed, purposed to do. Every one of them. Not just the oxygen in the air that you're breathing and going, wow, okay, I get the purpose of oxygen. It's for my respiration. All 100 of them have a purpose. Okay? And it really, if you let that sink in, that it should just really change the way you see the world. Okay? This isn't just a glob of matter. Okay? This is purpose made substance. Okay? And you know, so it should help you to take yourself out of this very circumscribed temporal viewpoint. And the fact that it doesn't, you know, when you observe the arm of this couch, you don't go, wow, that's exactly like looking at God. The fact that should remind you of how much there is to go yet. Okay, in maturing the atoms that happen to be in the arm of this couch right now. A trillion years from now, are they going to be in the arm of this couch? No. Where are they going to be? Well, they're going to be probably in a more purposed expression. Most likely, you know, they'll be unraveled and reassembled, you know. But the automatons are eventually all going to be locked into eternal purpose. Okay? Every automaton in Havona is locked into an eternal expression of purpose. Okay? It has no maturation left to go. Okay? And so, and the aisle is even a notch above that. Remember what we've said, you know, that they're really at a loss of words to try to say something about the aisle. You know, on the one hand, it's like, well, we could call it absolutum, and you can just think of it as really, really fancy dirt. But on the other hand, it manifests absolute purpose. Okay? I mean, it's so... To observe the substance of the aisle would be to observe something that's so beyond any notion you currently have of God, okay, that you would fall down and worship the aisle. Okay? I mean, it's such an incredible expression of perfect, absolute purpose that sometimes they just give up and they say, oh, let's just call it living. Okay? because what else are we going to... I mean, we need to somehow try to get it across to you that you can't just think about it as like fancy table material. Okay? It's so beyond any notion you have of God right now, okay, that you would think it was the most amazing personal spirit substance you'd ever experienced. And it's not one iota personal or one iota spirit. Okay, that's how immature and ignorant we are of these things. That's what they're trying to get you to appreciate. Okay? And every atom in this room, no matter what it's in, walls or tables or in molecules in the air, is a little downstepped expression of the purposeness of the aisle. Okay? The aisle is the pattern of infinity. The nucleus of the purposing of the totality of reality. Okay. And every atom is a little image of that. Every atom is made in the image of the aisle, just like you're made in the image of God. Okay? And if you really could appreciate an atom, you'd realize it's just as beautiful and just as magnificent as any notion of an angel that you've ever had. Okay? It's just as magnificently purposed and formed. Okay? That's what you're trying to get to here. You're trying to get so that you don't live in this dichotomy world, okay? Where unless the author, every three paragraphs, gives you another spiritual hit, like the first paragraph, you lose interest. It's like, well, I don't want to talk about things like this. They're not beautiful like God. No, they're so much more, actually more beautiful than any notion you have of God right now. Okay? They're gloriously magnificent little expressions, okay, of absolute beauty. The aisle. Anyone with eyes to see, no matter what you dig into, the deeper you dig, the more absolutely undeniable it is that there's a first source and center of all things and beings. Yeah. And he's not just good, he's not just true, he's beautiful. And everything he touches is beautiful. And he's touched every single atom. Okay, therefore it's beautiful. There's nothing in between his hand and that atom. It is beautiful, just like he is. Yeah. All right. So now, like Jason mentioned, you know, if you go up to paper 42, it's like, wait a minute, they skipped absoluta. Well, you know, they give a little mention to it here in the next paragraph.
Space potency is not subject to the interactions of any form of gravitation. This primal endowment of paradise is not an actual level of reality, but it is ancestral to all relative functional non-spirit realities, all manifestations of force energy, and the organization of power and matter. Space potency is a term difficult to define. It does not mean that which is ancestral to space. Its meaning should convey the idea of the potencies and potentials existent within space. It may be roughly conceived to include all those absolute influences and potentials which emanate from paradise and constitute the space presence of the unqualified absolute.
Definitely the first thing that you should get your hands on is that last little statement. I mean, the simplest way to begin to think about what that space potency is, what that absoluta is, it's just the presence, the space presence of the unqualified absolute, hence its name, absoluta, that which is inherently absolute. And let's just reinforce what we talked about when we were thinking about the center and surrounding circles of circumference on Nether Paradise. When we were talking about Nether Paradise, how it had that, you know, that tree ring like structure, okay, as you moved out from the core of it, okay, we reminded ourselves of what this fact they're just saying. When you say space potency, you don't mean that which could potentially be space. Okay, you mean the potency that's in space. Okay, therefore, space is prior, as a fact, is prior to that potency, prior to that presence of the unqualified absolute. And so, if you know that the space potency is tied to that outer part of Nether Paradise, and space is somehow tied to paradise too, it has to be tied to something more interior than that outer ring. It's got to be, you know, as you're going from the center out, you're going sort of causally, logically, you know, outward in the formation of things. So, yeah, you have to get to that which is tied to space before you get to that which is tied to space potency. Yeah, that's why that second ring is, you know, the zone, the unnamed zone around the zone of infinity. That's, you know, where space is anchored. Okay, in the picture. And then of course the co-infinite one, the Paradise Trinity is there at the zone of infinity, because that's the fact that actually is directly engaging infinity.
Just about everybody assumes that space potency is the antecedent to space. Once
you get away. Right. Yeah. So that's why they did that. It's so you can, okay, I get that. So now if I go back and try to think logically about Nether Paradise, oh, I get it. that's what that zone is for.
Paradise is the absolute source and the eternal focal point of all energy matter in the universe of universes. The unqualified absolute is the revealer, regulator, and repository of that which has paradise as its source and origin. The universal presence of the unqualified absolute seems to be equivalent to the concept of a potential infinity of gravity extension, an elastic tension of paradise presence. This concept aids us in grasping the fact that everything is drawn inwards toward paradise. The illustration is crude, but nonetheless helpful. It also explains why gravity always acts preferentially in the plane perpendicular to the mass, a phenomenon indicative of the differential dimensions of paradise and the surrounding creations.
This is the core of this paragraph is is full blown unity viewpoint stuff.
Yeah.
Let's just step through it a little bit here. They just mentioned the space presence of the unqualified absolute space potency, and they're going to expand on that a little bit. And so they say, this additional statement about the unqualified absolute. Now, in the individuality viewpoint, we have these three reservoirs of potential: the unqualified absolute, the universal absolute, the deity absolute. Okay. So certainly when I see the word repository associated with the designation the unqualified absolute, I should be going, oh yeah, okay, that makes complete sense. Instead of calling it a reservoir, they're calling it a repository. Okay, same difference. Okay, but wait a minute. Reservoirs or repositories don't have ER or OR suffixes. They don't have a gentive, you know, suffixes.
Doing.
The unqualified absolute, literally, that, you know, that designation can't be a revealer or a regulator. You got to turn. Right. That's the facet of deity. That's the other side of the picture. That's the infinite capacity. You know, and it's functioning. You know, it can function as a revealer and a regulator. Okay. That's the infinite capacity. So they're blending the two pictures. First two are the infinite capacity. The third one is the unqualified absolute. Remember how we said that's what you want to get to do too, you know, get to the point where you're doing is where you're seeing things, thinking about things from both the top-down and the bottom-up point of view, both the unity viewpoint and the individuality viewpoint at the same time. And if they do what they perforce must do like they did here, they've constructed this in an evolutional fashion where, you know, they were told to pretty much say it from the individuality viewpoint, but try to seed it forward from there. And so very seldom do they actually use the expression infinite capacity. You know, that's where, you know, that's paper 105 sort of stuff. You know, so most of the time they just use the individuality viewpoint names, but a lot of times they juxtapose it with obviously non sequitur words. Reservoirs, you know, are not revealers. Okay. Okay, so that, you see that. Now, the other thing that, you know, that really leaps out is this kind of curious central part of this paragraph. And anyone who's spent a little time like thinking about the foreword or some things like that, kind of your ears perk up when you see the word tension. You know, like this elastic tension. Okay? And they perk up in the sense that you remember the spots in the book where they talk about these three reservoirs. You know, and they talk about that bifurcation of you know, making the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute, just separating in these two halves. You know, and the more you separate it, the more tension there is between the two of them. And there's a reservoir that really, you know, you think of as embodying that tension between the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute. That's the universal absolute, that reservoir of tension. Okay? But now they're associating the tension with the unqualified absolute. What's the deal? Okay? The deal is that immediate thought you had about what the word tension was associated with, that's the time viewpoint picture. From a time viewpoint, you know, where you're thinking about the evolution, you know, we have these two substances, the reservoirs, and then you're resolving the difference between matter and spirit through mind. You know, you have that basic evolutional process of resolving that tension. But that's not the way it looks from an eternity viewpoint. If you flip it around to the eternity viewpoint, the tension picture is different. Okay. So you bring out the thing that is called the infinite eternal, okay, ellipse of total deity. Okay, if you're going to picture tension, and before I do that, you know, just what we did there, you know, we put the two, we have two endpoints, and the tension is in the middle. Unqualified absolute on one side, deity absolute on the other side, and the universal absolute in the middle, smack dab in the middle, embodying the tension between the two. Okay, when you look on this chart, okay, well now this outer circuits, the individuality circuit, you know, so I would expect to find those reservoir names there, you know, and I start looking, and sure enough, okay, there's the universal absolute, there's, you know, in level 6, there's the unqualified absolute in level 7, here's the deity absolute in level 2. Okay, so if I just look around that circuit, Okay, which two are on the end and which one is in the middle? The unqualified absolute's in the middle. Okay, this is on an end. That's in the middle, and this is on the other end. Now, in this picture, it's a little more complicated. The Paradise Trinity in between the two. But, yeah, forget about that for the moment. Remember, they mentioned that in the foreword, you know, that it's only through the... Okay, but anyway, you know, the deity absolute's on one end, the universal absolute's on the other end, the unqualified is in the middle. It's in the tension spot in the picture. Okay. Now, I mean... You can talk about that very specifically when you bring in, you know, the stuff we develop in total deity. But just take that basic, you know, there's truth in that layout. That isn't just random that they ended up like that. They're talking about it right here, see. When you look at the picture from the eternity viewpoint, the endpoints are the universal absolute and the deity absolute. And the unqualified embodies the tension between the two. That's the eternity viewpoint. And that the fact that that's true is manifest. And the fact that this phenomenon of gravity is, like they're saying, you can understand, you know, you can kind of wrap your mind around what's going on if you really think of it in intention terms. This extension of the aisle, remember, what's the infinite capacity? I am that which extends, okay. This extension, okay, has this tension character. And like they're saying, you know, it's an easy way to think about, okay, well, why do things kind of stay in a plane? Well, if you kind of imagine that there's like rubber bands, you know, there's a tension. I pull it up, it gets pulled back down. I pull it down, it gets pulled back up, you know. It has this tension that keeps it in a plane. Remember, we talked about that when we talked about Nether Paradise. That's, you know, the east-west differential, you know, is related, you know, to this angle and the spherical coordinates. Okay, there's an effective zeroing tension there, you know, like there's springs on both sides. Okay. Yeah, so now that's what they're alluding to there. I mean, obviously it's a bit crude, like they're saying, but it's predicated in fact. You know, if you look mathematically at the infinite capacity, the infinite potential, and the infinite upholder. Yeah, you see that you can look at the differential in two different ways. Those two different ways are the time viewpoint and the eternity viewpoint. And in the eternity viewpoint, the differential, you know, is the unqualified absolute.
Okay? Is that how you see it when you read paper 105, when they list them in those?
Not necessarily there. I mean, it doesn't really come out until you put paper 105 together with the foreword and start developing the total DD picture. You know, and then it's just right there in front of you. You know, we'll talk about that, you know, as we go through the seminar more. We'll talk about that, you know, literally, specifically. But anyway, that's, you know, so just, I mean, just appreciate that that's why it ends up like this on the chart. You know, that unqualified absolute is in between the two. And it's the thing, it's sort of the super additive consequence. It's the domain towards which everything is sort of moving, you know, to try to somehow bring the two deity absolutes up into resolution with the non-deity absolute. Then we'll really have transcended some differentials. See, that's the eternity viewpoint. Yeah. All right, so just let that kind of percolate in your mind, you know, going forward. That's the kind of stuff, see, that they've woven in here, these little teasers like that, in a sense. But all the words are there. Extension, tension... All the words are there so that you can eventually put the pieces together once you get it all figured out. And then you can directly understand what that sentence is referring to. And you go, wow, okay, I could actually write that sentence now. I mean, I understand what they're thinking about when they wrote that sentence. Okay. Maybe just one little thing that'll kind of seed us going forward in next week when we finish up the paper. This line they throw in there, okay, seems to be equivalent to the concept of a potential infinity of gravity extension. Remember that that's always in play here. In the next section, we're going to actually read that statement about the aisle being at the center, being the center of infinity. And this whole notion about where is the aisle, like when we were talking about this room being everything, and the aisle is not in the room. It's like, well, where is the aisle? Okay. Another way to think about that is, if you could see the cosmos infinite, if the whole cosmos infinite, you know, extending in infinite distance in every direction, if the whole cosmos infinite was visible to you, in that picture, at the center, would be the aisle. The aisle literally is at the center of the cosmos infinite, if you could see it. But you can't see the cosmos infinite. All you can see is a massively downstepped picture of the cosmos infinite, clear down to the dregs of the finite. That's all you can see. That's why you can't see the aisle, because the aisle is at the center of the cosmos infinite, literally, directly. It's at the center of infinity. Okay? And you're just seeing a shadow. Okay? And in terms of the shadow that you see projected, the aisle is a literal blob of stuff isn't there in the shadow picture. Its centering influence is, the master universe picture you see has this big center of symmetry thing to it. Okay, that's the shadow cast by the aisle. But it's a very high fact. I mean, you think, well, if I transcend the super universes and go into Havona, certainly I could journey to the center of Havona and I'd find the aisle there. No, Havona's not the cosmos infinite. The aisle isn't at the center of the central universe either. The aisle is only literally at the center of the cosmos infinite. Okay? And all you're experiencing so far of the cosmos infinite is this very shadowy, finite portion of it. From the eternity viewpoint, remember, you have the cosmos infinite. It's all there. See, and that's another thing. I mean,
Havona is a co-eternal to the cosmos.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of, you know, obviously it gets hard to think about, you know, okay. I mean, you know that there's nowhere that they suggest that when you actually are a finality or standing on paradise, you know, that you can get your spyglass out and look at the cosmos infinite. You know, you just look out and see the seven super universes and, you know, and whatnot, okay. It's because, yeah, you've made it into a measure of relationship with eternity, but not an infinite relationship with eternity. To just turn the whole picture around and not think of it in this temporal viewpoint where there is no cosmos infinite, there is no populated outer space level. I mean, actually, there is the cosmos infinite, and you're just experiencing this very shadowy part of that total picture. You know, that's flipping it around to an eternity viewpoint. And so over a vast sequence, forget about time, over a vast sequence of experiences, you slowly, your view expands and you can see more and more of the cosmos infinite until finally, after endless cycles of experiential sequence, get rid of time and eternity and all kinds of words like that, but just endless completions and repletions, you know, endless cycles of wrapping experience around us in this sequence and that sequence from every direction. Eventually, you will see the whole cosmos infinite. But it'll take you a long time to develop the internal eyes to relate to the cosmos infinite. And when you do see the cosmos infinite, after endless cycles of eternity, when you see it, right smack at the center, literally right there will be the aisle. That's where the aisle is. Okay? It's at the geographic center of the cosmos infinite, not at the geographic center of the master universe or the grand universe or even the central universe.
We wish that there was some equivalent planetarium style presentation that we could be sat down and the lights would go off and it would just, you know, all be explained. But I don't think that it can't be ever done like that, because you can't explain something that you're inside of. In other words, to understand it in that way, you have to be outside of it to look back at it, and we're never going to be outside of it.
Yeah. See, it's so much like growth. See, you're not aware of it in the moment. You're only aware of it in retrospect. I mean, because that's the nature of being an experiential fact. You're never going to be an existential fact. Perforce, you must always only see it in the rearview mirror, you know, by turning around. Oh, that's what, you know. You can't experience it in the moment. But an existential fact, like the first source and center of all things and being, sees it in a totally different way. He sees the cosmos infinite, you know, and the infinite beings and things in it. That's what he sees. You know, and then the fact that that's what he sees, it's like, well, how does he even know about me as a temporal fact then? If I can't see the aisle, even when I'm in Havona, how does he see me? The mystery of mysteries. See? That's that mystery. He can see what, from our perspective, should be unseeable, because he has another port of view. He doesn't view it this way, he views it back around the other way. Okay, he can see the end from the beginning. He can, you know, or however you want to talk about it. That's he's not limited to any sort of an experiential viewpoint, no matter how vast it is. He sees it transcendent of an experiential viewpoint. He sees it only as an existential viewpoint.
To him, the starting point of what he sees is infinity. For us, it's just the opposite.
Almost. Yeah, it's nothing.
It's scarcity.
Yeah.
Scarcity is where, right, we start from.
Yeah, we see so little, we believe in the vacuum. Yeah, I mean, that's right. How little we see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. See? If we don't exercise faith, we'll just revert to.
We see so little that even beings a lot higher than us can write the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. That's how little we see. Okay. Yeah. As experiential beings. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, then the next time we'll finish up, and then, you know, we'll roll right over into the universe of universes, which will kind of be appropriate. We'll get the center of infinity picture, and then we'll start to sort out infinity. So let's take a moment to reflect on it here.